This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Sure, I think we ought to insist that teachers not allow their kids to be putting up hate-filled signs until they've actually learned to spell basic words.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, Rick the Black Swan Hess.
Hey, baby.
I always thought of you as a black swan.
I've often felt like a black swan.
You were the factor that people didn't see coming. The unions 10 years ago that, you know, they said what could you know challenge us in the decade to come, and they didn't anticipate Rick Hess.
I often felt when I was younger like Natalie Portman, and I just didn't realize what it was.
Yeah.
But now I know.
Yeah.
I was just intuiting the black swanness of her.
You're more like Natalie Portman in Black Swan than you are like Natalie Portman in the Star Wars movies.
The prequels. God, I hope so. The prequels, she was horrible. Oh, she was fine, but the movies were so terrible.
Ah, okay.
She had to hang out with Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah, right. I don't know who that is.
That just kills you.
All right, so Rick, we got a lot to talk about. Suddenly an outburst of education news and events this week, it
Ooh.
Seems. So we are going to talk about them.
That's what we do.
because we have to get you out of here because I understand you're off to have drinks with Randy Weingarten.
Yeah, yeah.
You are a true Washington insider, aren't you?
I suppose. At least I dressed the part.
You know, I will say one of the last times I had dinner downtown in Washington, D.C., it was with you and an NEA vice president.
The NEA vice president. There's only one.
Oh. Wow. Well, Fordham's tiny, and we have two at the current right now. No, it's pretty good. Well, and it was a lovely dinner, and she's very lovely, and this is what happens.
Which organization is the bureaucratic monolith?
Uh-huh. It's a good question. Okay. How many vice presidents does AEI have?
Do we have any? Yes, we must. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll have to find this out.
Probably several. Okay. It's time to get going. Daniela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
All right, guys. Akron, Ohio mother of two, Kelly Williams-Bolar, has made national headlines after getting locked up for attempting to send her kids to a school in a better and whiter district. Is she the Rosa Parks of the school reform movement?
What do you think, Rick? Is this the right analogy?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds to me like somebody who wants, you know, people live in these adjacent districts paying taxes for their kids to go to school. They bought a home there. Strikes me. I'm not sure why what she's doing is entirely different from shoplifting.
Wow, Rick, look at you. I mean, do you want to just totally get kicked out of the school choice movement? I mean, you're already most of the way out. They're just going to slam the door in your butt, my friend.
But you know, it's one thing. I mean, if we were saying, look, I understand the argument. Let's change the rules because we think that it'd be nice for her kids to be able to go to better schools. Although that seems to me...
Well, but the same thing. I mean, the rule at the time was that Rosa Parks was not allowed to sit where she did on the bus.
Yeah.
But the point is still that was an unjust law. And people are saying, look, it's unjust to have these arbitrary boundaries.
But she's hardly the first person to lie about where her kids live to go to... I mean, this has been going on forever.
Right.
And I've never thought it was particularly admirable behavior.
All right. Well, so it's a form of civil disobedience, perhaps, right? I mean, she did her time, you know, so there you have it. And yes, she did. She broke the rules and she lied. And you could consider it stealing, but only because the way we have our school system set up that says you have to be rich enough to buy into a certain school system. Mm-hmm. We should at least admit that these are not public schools we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are. Well, we have to admit that what public school means isn't nearly as cut and dried as the opponents of vouchers want to suggest.
You know, a year ago, Janie Skull here at Fordham and I published a little report called America's Private Public Schools. We found 3,000 schools around the country that serve virtually no poor students. Mm-hmm. And yet they have the public label and, you know, the unions and others will proudly declare how they support public education. But yet everybody knows, you know, these are private systems. And the system is you buy into the neighborhood. The neighborhoods are by and large designed to not have any affordable housing in them. And then, sure, if you can buy in, you get to go to the school there. But that's not very much different than going to a segregated private school.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, is she the Rosa Parks, Rick? Yes or no?
And she's somebody who lied and to get her kids something she wanted for them. And I understand why she would do it, and I sympathize. But it strikes me as peculiar that she has become a folk hero.
Okay, topic number two.
I just want to say quickly, I'm so excited that Rick is back. It brings up the podcast up a notch in terms of controversy, and it's fantastic, really. Question number two. Mike, you were quoted in a recent New York Times article on the fight against teacher tenure laws. You said, and to quote, these new Republican governors are all trying to out-reform one another. In your humble opinions, who is the most education reform-minded of them all?
Well, it's probably too early to tell. Certainly, Chris Christie has a year lead on all of them and has done some good work in that time, certainly rhetorically, and he's been pushing the right issues. But there's a whole crop of them that are very interesting. You've got Sandoval out in Nevada, who's pushing for some interesting school choice stuff. You've got several of them talking about reforming tenure and really being tough on budget stuff, from John Kasich in Ohio to Rick Scott in Florida. And then, you know, I would say that one of the most interesting Republican governors on reform is Andrew Cuomo in New York, who is, you know, for the most part, saying all the right things and coming out with a pretty serious budget proposal. Rick, what do you think?
Although, so one thing is right. So it's not all these governors. There's about a half. There's an exciting half dozen.
Right. But, oh, I should have mentioned Mitch Daniels deserves a mention, too.
But, you know, and Walker potentially in Wisconsin, maybe. But but you go there and that's terrific. I mean, it's great to have a half dozen Republican governors running with the ball. But let's just be clear that it's not all of the Republican governors.
No, I know. But you look back to the 90s or even the late 80s, and we used to always talk about these education governors. Mm-hmm. And again, it was only a half dozen, but it made a difference. It made an impact.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the neat things here is that, you know, these governors pushing as aggressively as they are creates a huge opportunity for superintendents in major districts who want to get out front and be seen as allies. You know, whoever winds up the superintendent in Newark, say, or the superintendent in Trenton in New Jersey, the superintendent in Indianapolis, if he were more proactive on this front, for Dwight Jones in Clark County with Sandoval, I think there's huge opportunities for smart big district soups to get out front and cut some deals with these governors.
Yeah, excellent. So do you have a sense of which of these is going to be the star 12 months from now?
I don't. Do you?
No. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you've got, look, again, well, Mitch Daniels has a lead, too, as with Governor Christie. And it looks like in Indiana, they're pushing some pretty serious stuff, including going right after the collective bargaining law. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is a governor who has some interest in running for president. We understand he's built a heck of a policy team there. So that's interesting. John, you know, I'm biased because Ohio is Fordham's home. And John Kasich certainly has a lot of interest in being serious, too.
But it's tough. You know, it's like with popcorn. Sometimes the kernels pop. Sometimes they don't. Bobby Jindal's actually been slugging away on this for about 4 years.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, it looked like he was going to be the next exciting GOP governor on education. And you don't hear him talked about as much in that cluster. Yep. So a little bit of it's going to be how events play out and who catches the media spotlight.
Okay. Topic number three.
Okay, last question. In honor of Education Next's 10th anniversary, you two participated in a forum assessing whether ed reformers have, in fact, won the war of ideas. So have they?
Yes and no.
I'll go. They've won the war of ideas, and they're actually very much at risk of being the worse off for it.
Yeah. This Rick and I teamed up on this essay with Marty West. And on the other side were Checker, Paul Peterson, and Marcy Canstrom, who basically said, sure, you know, the reformers have won the air war, but, you know, the ground war is still held by the same old interests. I interviewed Checker in a video, and he said it really well in the video. He said it's like facadism in architecture, you know, where you keep the facade the same, but everything inside changes. He said it's the exact opposite in education. The facade has changed, but everything on the inside is much the same.
Absolutely. You know, one of the fun things that this brings to mind is Checker and I wrote a piece on innovation probably about 4 or 5 years ago when we talked about the Potemkin Village phenomenon. Well, one of the easiest ways for districts and states to catch reform fever is you put up a little demonstration village. You have a school in your district, which is now a reform school, or you let a couple of charters go off to the races, or you institute a pilot pay program. But underneath, you know, you peel off that veneer, and 98% of everything is going on as it always has. Yeah. The real opposition, I mean, I think ultimately our take and Checker and Paul Peterson and Marcy's take wasn't all that different. Mm-hmm. The real difference, Jay Green sent around an interesting, I guess, blog post he put up on his website today where he called us all a whole bunch of nattering nabobs of negativism who fail to ever appreciate the good news. Mm-hmm. And we're all too quick to worry about things.
Yeah.
And I think that might really be the most most interesting debate.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, in our piece, what we tried to say was, look, there hasn't been enough humility among the reformers. We get attached to these ideas and drive them in very particular ways. So it's not enough to just say that there should be some performance pay within the teaching profession. It's that it has to be at least 50% on teachers' value-added scores.
And we're going to test it, and we're going to run a test in Nashville, and we're going to see whether or not test scores went up.
Right.
And if they do, and if they don't, then we've got to say, uh-oh, maybe our idea was wrong, rather than being, you know, thoughtful about what the heck it is we're really trying to do.
Okay. Thanks for playing Pardon the Gadfly, Daniela. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
How you doing? Nice to be here.
So I'm curious. You might be too, Amber. So, Rick, when you have drinks with Randy Weingarten, what do you order and what does she order?
This is the kind of stuff that you got to keep in the vault.
Oh, come on.
Being part of the DC firmament, as you know, means that you have to be able to respect the things that are privately held. You know that.
All right. So Rick orders either a Bud Light or a rum and Coke. Am I right?
I'm not.
And Randy orders something much more sophisticated than
I'm
that.
I'm not at liberty to divulge this kind of material.
All right, Amber. Well, if we're not going to get that out of it, maybe we can at least talk about some exciting education research.
All right. So it's kind of linking to teacher pay. You guys were just kind of batting that around. It's a new study out by Boston Foundation. It's kind of like a forensic accounting study. It looks at salary and benefit expenditures in Boston public schools. Kind of gives some bleak picture here about how we've failed to rethink teacher pay. Key findings for 10-11 school year, 82%, which really... Wow. Of the BPS budget are $671 million is spent on employee salaries and benefits combined. Teacher salaries comprise 49% of the total BPS budget. Boston teachers can attain maximum salary in 9 years, which is quicker than in most of the rest of the largest districts in the country. I'm just going to keep going. It's just gets worse. Each step increases their salary 5-6% a year. We know that, but that compounded by the negotiated salary increase. So in some cases, we're talking 10% a year. Over 80% of Boston teachers hold a master's degree or higher, 80%.
That's terrific. That means they've got a first-rate teaching course.
Right. Anyway, average base salary in the master's degree level is $70,000. Roughly 59% of teachers fall in the highest step, which is step 9, master's degree plus a chunk of credits. We don't guess how much these teachers are getting with a master's degree, step 9, chunk of credits.
Oh, probably 42,000-43,000 a year.
Yeah. Let's 93K, that would be.
That doesn't suck.
Woo. In 2009, $10 million was paid out for accumulated sick leave, of which teachers get 15 sick days, 4 personal days, and no limit on the amount of sick time that they can accumulate. Last little factoid. Elementary teachers are required to be at school 6 hours and 30 minutes, of which 4 hours and 42 minutes is direct instruction.
Wow. Ooh. Wow. You know, somebody, first of all, let me be clear. I have no problem with paying teachers a good salary. And in fact,
no,
I think we've done a bad job at that. And you look over time by any indicator, and there's been stagnation in salaries. And all the money's gone to benefits and raising class or lowering class size. It's a big mistake. However, I think it would be fun to say, if you were a family in Boston, and the wife and the husband were both teachers at the maximum step, and you were making, therefore, $186,000 a year, where would that put you in terms of compared to Americans writ large? Would that be the top 5% of the income earners? I think that'd be kind of interesting to look at. But now, I had another point, but I'm not going to make it right now, Amber.
And you could each take 15 sick days a year.
Right.
Plus 4 personal days. So that's 4 weeks. You could basically take the month of May off.
Yeah.
And go beat everybody to the vacation spots.
One small bright spot in here. They actually, apparently in 2001, figured out that the teachers need to pay more in pension. So they bumped it up to 11% of what teachers pay from their salaries. I guess in 2001, it's something like 5%. I mean, prior, you know, right. Teachers who've had 35 years are paying them 5%. If you're in 01 or later, you're paying 11%. So there's some recognition, you know, that something's got to change. But the rest of the picture was completely bleak.
But let me ask you this, though. You seem to deride the fact that they could get to their maximum salary in so quickly.
Nine years.
I thought that's actually a good thing, that there's concerns that in other in other careers, people have a much steeper curve as they gain skills, and that in education, it was taking too long.
Yeah,
for
I was kind of scratching my head about that because, and I, maybe you guys can help me with a theory, because after 9 years, you get a pay increase every 5 years. That's about, I don't know, 3,000, then it's 5,000. So it kind of, the whole picture changes after 9 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still eligible for, you know, all these other little pots of money. But yeah, I mean, I was surprised by that. I mean, what's the thinking of, you know, maxing out at 9 years and every 5 years getting a big chunk of raise?
Mm-hmm. Plus your COLAs. So.
Right.
It's, I mean, the problem is, right, that you'd like to think if you're paying somebody 9 years in, you know, 90 plus grand, that you're getting more, right, they're doing more good than somebody mm-hmm. who's making a lot less money. Mm-hmm. So for me, the problem is less that you get them up to max salary, but they're getting max salary for doing the exact same job right. they were doing 9 years previous.
Right.
Which is just, it's just so, I don't know of any profession where your responsibilities as you earn more money go unchanged.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the song that goes along with this, Amber?
So since we're talking about teacher pay, we've got Johnny Kemp singing Just Got Paid. Remember the song? Just Got Paid.
Let's hear it.
Just got paid, it's Friday night. Party hunter, feeling right. Body shaking, it's all around. No one there.
Now it's time for our new hit segment, Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that? Yes, sir.
There's more than one way to ignite tension between different schools. A classic annual matchup of two competitive sports teams will do the trick. Take two schools and put them in the same building, and now we're brewing bad blood. Such is the case for Harlem Success Academy, a charter school occupying space in New York's Public School 149 building. And never was it more evident than last week when some PS 149 students posted signs around the building, antagonizing their charter school counterparts prior to a hearing on the space-sharing arrangement. One particularly classy sign read, "Charter schools are like Hitler, tyrants trying to take what's not theirs." First off, maybe if these students cared a little more about what is being taught in their building as opposed to who's occupying it, the sign wouldn't have been laced with such egregious spelling errors. Secondly, a Hitler reference? Really? It's not like any other political figures have used power to acquire something that wasn't theirs. And truly, there's nothing the general public respects more than people going way over the top while trying to make their point. So let's stick to thinking about more of the pleasant, unifying moments in Germany's history. It's not nice to bring up embarrassing moments from other people's past. Misspelled hate signs comparing a school to one of the worst dictators in the history of the world? Do I even need to say it? What's up with that?
Yeah, it's particularly the spelling that galls me.
Hitler's okay? But no, they spelled Hitler right.
And at least it's a historic, a historic reference. But I mean, you can't spell theirs properly. Veers, is that a word in French or something when you flip the I and the E?
Something like that.
And I mean, a misspelled tyrants with an E? Mm-hmm. I mean, who spells tyrants with an E?
Good question. So, but in all seriousness, there are reasons that the public schools get frustrated, that the charter schools come over and they feel like they're taking over their schools, that they're, you know, look, there's real tension. This is a resource allocation issue, right? And resource allocation issues often lead to conflict. I mean, should we just try to basically avoid this situation as much as possible and put charter schools in a different place?
I think we ought to insist that teachers not allow their kids to be putting up hate-filled signs until they've actually learned to spell basic words.
And then they're allowed to pull it up.
Well, then it's earned autonomy.
All right. We should finish on that note, everybody. Thanks. Until next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, always available at edexcellence.net. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.